Some months, you're flooded with jobs and make multiple placements. Other months, a big fat zero. This feast and famine cycle isn't just stressful, it's holding you back and keeping you from real predictable growth. Here's the good news. There's a reason it's happening, and you can fix it. The 7-Figure Freedom Scorecard is a free tool designed for recruitment business owners. In less than 10 minutes, it evaluates your firm across the 6 key pillars of sustainable growth: clients, candidates, team, operations, marketing, and strategy. Your personalized scorecard will reveal what's working and what's broken, and the fastest way to build a recruitment business that generates consistent 7-figure revenue month after month. Stop riding the revenue roller coaster and take the free scorecard now at recruitmentcoach.com/scorecard.
I think I learned a lot during that chapter, because I think when you start your own agency, there's always going to be imposter syndrome. You know, am I adding enough value to this experienced recruiter? I'm giving them great commissions. I'm doing my best to provide L&D. But I think you're always in that internal battle of like, am I doing enough?
Seb Sharp built a $4 million recruiting firm in 7 years. Now he and his co-founder are building a completely new model for the recruiting industry. One designed for an industry that they believe is about to fundamentally change.
If you look at the macroeconomic trends of where the gig economy is going, and then you look under a microscope of what the, you know, the bread and butter of recruitment is in terms of the soft skills, I think it's going to be the next industry that's hit by this. And you look at trainers, you look at wealth managers, you look at realtors, they're all pivoting to this kind of entrepreneurial structure. They look for platforms instead of companies. It's my hypothesis that recruiting will be next. And while we've got about 270,000 recruiters in America, I don't think that that number will necessarily diminish. But I think that instead of 26,000 agencies, it's going to be more like 100,000 agencies who take advantage of this more autonomous way of work.
I'm Mark Whitby, and you're listening to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. My guest today is one of our clients, Seb Sharp. Seb is the co-founder of Inventure, a specialist renewable energy search firm based in Los Angeles. Seb launched Inventure in 2018 with his childhood friend, Charlie Rawlings. They started with no clients and no track record, but with a tight niche, a focus on retained and exclusive work, and a willingness to grind.
In recruiting, even if you're not particularly good, if you work very, very hard, you will see success. If you are using the right tools, of course.
In this episode, Seb breaks down exactly how they build a $4 million business that has been profitable every quarter, including the one KPI that drove consistent growth at every stage.
The first year or two was, you know, financially very good. I mean, we did $1 million in our first year. We doubled that in our second year. We were profitable every single quarter. And
he also shares why he believes the recruiting industry is about to fragment and what he and Charlie are building to get ahead of it.
About sort of 9 months ago or so, Charlie and I thought, I think our mission is to build the infrastructure for the next era of recruiter, which we think to be more entrepreneurial, more high leverage. And ultimately, we think that instead of America having maybe 26,000 agencies, you know, in 5 years, which it does today, it's going to be more like 100,000 agencies. About 80% of all companies have less than 10 people. And we think that it's going to fragment even more.
If you want to understand where this industry is heading and how to benefit from those changes, this conversation is essential listening. All right, Seb, so good to see you again. How have you been?
Mark, it's a pleasure. I've been good. You know, it's another February day here in Los Angeles, so no complaints at all. Yeah, great.
Fantastic. Well, we've been talking about doing this for a long time, and now it seems like the timing is perfect because you and Charlie are launching something huge, which we'll get into. But take me back to your start in recruiting. How did you get into it? And then how did you hook up with Charlie?
Oh, okay, two very different stories. But I'll start with the recruiting. So I just graduated UCLA. And I think at the time,
so
I
wait,
had...
pause right here.
Yeah.
You're obviously British. Why were you at UCLA?
Great question. So it's a funny story, really. I had a holiday that I went to in Hawaii, and we stopped off at LA on the way because it's an enormous journey from England. And we just stopped in LA for a couple of days, and we were doing some sightseeing, and we happened upon the UCLA campus. And if you've ever been, it's just a beautiful place. And you know, we were there sort of during sunset, and I sort of thought to myself, I wonder if this is an option. So that became like my absolute obsession as a, you know, 16, 17 year old, figured out a way to get in. And it was the only school I applied to in America, and I got in. So,
Wow, that's cool.
And now I've been here for almost 14 years, which is, you know, a long time.
Amazing. All right. So then fast forward, you graduated, and what happened next?
So I graduated, I think, through college. I had initially wanted to be a talent agent, probably watched too much Entourage or something. You know, that's the job to take in Los Angeles. And I was
sorry
was
to interrupt. I keep interrupting you, Seb. We actually have two clients that started out in that world before they got into recruiting. So if you're listening, then shout out to Catherine Wilcox and Amanda Brandenburg. Both of them start out in the talent agency world in LA before finding the recruiting side of things.
That's amazing. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all because, I mean, again, just kind of leading to the path in recruiting, I think it's such an analogous industry and, you know, you're dealing with people. And so I think through this sort of organic, you know, job discovery phase as a fresh grad, I came upon a company that would sponsor a visa, an E2, a company called GQR. So I started out there and it was certainly, a wake-up call to the sort of the real world of work. If you know about GQR, I mean, it was, 7 till 7 every day, you know, be on the phones at 7 a.m. And it was, you know, classic post-grad life. I was, you know, taking public transport to work. I would run home 5 miles every day to save money. And it's a low salary, high commission job. So it was a great training ground to launch my career.
Awesome. And so then how did you end up meeting Charlie? And then you launched your own firm in venture.
So I've known Charlie since I was probably 12. We went to school together. And you know, we had always had those kind of discussions, like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, one day we're going to run a business together. And, you know, essentially I'd been at GQR. I had kind of gone out to Chicago to launch an office there. And I was working kind of on my own for a while. Charlie was in finance. He was working at PwC in London. And I think just organically, I mean, recruiting is such an entrepreneurial profession. You know, you're winning a lot of clients yourself. You're closing candidates. And I just, you know, of course, had the entrepreneurial itch and thought, I wonder if I could do this on my own. And, you know, Charlie was obviously the first person I'd call because of that. And he was coming to that kind of same crossroads in his career. And so we started making a business plan. We put pen to paper on what it might look like to launch a business together. And I think that's kind of how it goes, really. All of a sudden, we had a business plan and we thought, what the hell? Why don't we just go for it and do it? So Charlie flew out to Chicago. He gave recruiting a try. I kind of walked him through what it looked like. He followed me for like a week. And then after that, we were like, yeah, let's go. So we launched in New York in sort of December 2018, start of 2019.
Wow. So good for Charlie for like a weekend. Yep, let's do it. That's hilarious. Because this business is not easy, right? And it's not, you know, for the faint of heart. So yeah. So look, then there's the adventure journey, right? And so I think we should spend a bit of time on that chapter. And so here's my sort of game plan from this call, Seb, just so that you're like following along with me. So adventure is obviously a really important chapter because that's been like your entrepreneurial journey up until very recently. And then I'd like to talk about, and through that process, you have successfully, so not only were you a top billy yourself, but then you've obviously trained and developed a lot of recruiters at Inventure and figured out how to get people successful, you know, and billing and sustainably. So I'd love to hear any kind of golden nuggets that you can offer to recruiters out there listening that have been kind of like the key principles that to your success and your team at Inventure. And then we'll sort of look at Generate and why you guys have launched that. Does that sound like a good game plan?
Let's do it. That sounds great.
Fantastic. So you guys launched in New York. And were you always focused on renewable energy or how did that shape up?
Yeah. So actually, no, when we first launched the business, we were in the first ever WeWork. So Adam Newman literally did the wiring himself, and we were above the subway. It would rattle every time a train came past. And it was just me and Charlie in one of those classic WeWork box offices, which was great. Such a good start. And we started out initially doing my old industry, which was private equity, accounting and finance. That was our initial market. Within the first year, a few old colleagues of mine from GQR, super talented recruiters, one was in renewable energy, the other one, well, there was two, came from kind of quant trading / kind of startup engineering. So within the first year, we had a private equity, accounting and finance, renewable energy, and quant engineering. So we kind of took a leaf out of the GQR book initially. I know they've specialized since, but three different industries, and the main kind of linear similarity was the way that we were working and the values that we held. So those were our markets initially.
Okay, wow, fantastic. But it was a bit of a bumpy ride, because as any business owner listening knows, being a good biller and then running a recruitment agency are different skill sets. And just because you can run a desk doesn't mean that you're going to be able to build a firm, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's such an important point. I think, if you look at the US recruitment industry today, there's 26,000 agencies, and around 80% of them have less than 10 people. And I think the reality is most of those agencies comprise of a very heavy hitting recruiter or two, and they're trying to run a full desk, which is in and of itself a big job. Then they're trying to manage probably some up and comers, you know, the grads or whoever. And then they're also trying to add a lot of value to, you know, the middle pack of recruiters that are, you know, getting good. They're wanting more and more value from their manager. And, you know, naturally they start to look around and go, I wonder if I could do this on my own, you know, because there's a leader there that's split across so many different things. And so it's a cliche thing to say, but the billing manager it's such a hard thing to do. And I think me and Charlie were probably way too bloody young. I think we were about 24 when we were initially running the agency, and we were trying to do exactly that. The folks that joined us were also similar in age. So all of those things were amplified for sure.
What were the biggest kind of challenges or roadblocks, setbacks for you guys with InVenture in the early days?
Well, I think the first big hurdle that we ran into was that we had initially planned to kind of launch the business in New York and scale it out of New York, because Charlie and I had neither of us had lived there, and we thought this is the place to be. But very quickly, the folks that we had recruited were based in Los Angeles. And then we continued to hire a few more people. We went from just me and Charlie to sort of six or seven people quite fast. And they were all in Los Angeles. And I think, you know, one morning on a Sunday, kind of Charlie, we were living together as well. Charlie came into my room and goes, "Mate, our business is in Los Angeles. What are we doing in New York? We got to go." So change of plan. We packed up and went back to LA, which I was familiar with. And so there was the geographic change. And then I think within about 2 or 3 weeks of moving there, COVID hit. So big pivot, COVID came around, and then we were immediately to the, I won't go on too much about that chapter, but it was each of us working remotely at home. And so again, I mentioned that theme of like being focused on adding value to experienced recruiters. And you could imagine how much harder that was when you were then working remotely straight away. So I think those were the two of the biggest hurdles. But then I think I learned a lot during that chapter, because I think when you start your own agency, there's always going to be imposter syndrome. You know, am I adding enough value to this experienced recruiter? I'm giving them great commissions. I'm doing my best to provide L&D. But I think you're always in that internal battle of like, am I doing enough? And so I think during that period, like we certainly towards the end of that, we lost a few folks who decided, yes, I want to go and do this on my own. A VC company hired our quant recruiter. She was absolutely brilliant. And so I think during that time, we kind of evolved from, all right, we're going to build this agency with people with 3 or 4 or 5 years of experience and pivot ultimately to an academy model. And we thought, what better way to prove to ourselves that we can add a hell of a lot of value to our team than to train grads from scratch? And, the first year or two was, you know, financially very good. I mean, we did $1 million in our first year. We doubled that in our second year. We were profitable every single quarter, and we were smart with cash. But I think that there was that kind of you know, that feeling of being pulled in two directions. It was successful, but the imposter syndrome was setting in. So the Academy was born from that feeling, I think. And it was just, and Mark, I think that's probably when we actually first met each other and got onto the Apex, which was, you know, yeah, shout out to the Apex group. It's just, that was an unbelievable chapter of learning and opened my eyes to how much you can learn by, you know, being embedded in a group of individuals in the same boat. But I can then go into the Academy chapter, but those were a few initial bumps in the road that I can reflect on.
So, okay, first of all, explain to me how you did $1 million in your first year from scratch and were profitable every quarter, because I would have assumed that at least the first quarter, if not the first two, you'd be making a loss. Is that real profit, or is this you guys weren't paying yourselves?
We paid ourselves a small base salary, very small base salary. But, you know, at GQR, I was quite good at pitching retainers, and I had built up sort of a name for myself in the Chicago market for private equity. So on the very first day of business, literally our first day of business, I ripped through a kind of a Rolex of contacts that I knew of. And I said, you know, hey, and I think the key when you start out is to have a bit of vulnerability. You know, you want to be really assured in your mission and say, look, we've spun out to do things our own way and here's how we're going to do it. But also, we're brand new. I'm wondering if you know anybody who could be, you know, take a bit of value from the skills I have. So on the first day, we ripped through this list, and I was fortunate enough to you know, call the right person at the right time, and we landed a $30,000 retainer on day one. So it was a flying start. And Charlie's like, "What the hell? This is easy." No, I'm just
it's
joking.
A bit of false, you know, self confidence there, but false sense of security is the word I was looking for. So can we just double click on this for a second, Seb? Because I think this is a really interesting technique, and I've not heard anyone else share that. So what you're saying is your pitch on day one was what? Could you break that down for me in terms of what you said and why you think it worked?
Yeah. So it's just speaking from experience. I think there's a balance, right? You have to be very self-assured. I don't think any company wants to work with somebody who's kind of like, hey, I'm going out on my own. And I'm just going to kind of see what I figured I'd just, you know, give it a go. You have to be very concise in your mission. So for us, we were saying something like, look, we worked at a business that had an array of industries, and me and a few individuals have broken off to do things in a very specific way. And then I can get into the client values that we had and things like that. But it was very intentional. We're going out to specialize in an area and we want to have a very specific set of values. But with that said, you know, we've got X many years of experience in the industry. We've got 3, 4, 5 years of experience in the industry, but this is a new logo and we're looking to make a splash in the market. So it's like you're positioning yourself as this exciting new thing that's very intentional, but also very vulnerable. Hey, do you know anybody who, you know, might be of interest to me right now? And then also like come armed to those calls with a lot of value. So make sure that you're coming in with some kind of, not necessarily market research, but, you know, perhaps you've spoken to a few other CFOs in the last couple of months and you've got some market intel where even if they leave the call and they go, hey, Seb, sorry, I've got no one, you can say, oh, well, by the way, I spoke to a few people over here. I'm curious to know if that could be of value to you. So you're adding value. But, you know, as I say, it's this balance of being very intentional with what you're trying to do with your company, but also vulnerable and letting them know that you're new. And I think that vulnerability kind of speaks to them on a human level, and they've probably been there at some point in their career, or, you know, they've invested in a company that's gone down that path. And you know, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, I think at the core of everybody, like, you want to help people, you want to feel important. And yeah, that resonated, and we got, as I said, we got that retainer, and I think we got two or three other searches on exclusive from a sister company of one of my old clients. And
here's what I keep hearing from clients who have switched to Recruiter Flow. They are executing faster, not working longer hours, but using a platform that just makes sense. Recruiter Flow is an AI-first ATS and CRM built specifically for recruitment agencies and executive search firms. No confusing menus, no endless buttons you'll never use. When someone new joins your team, they're up and running in hours, not weeks. And here's the thing. When your recruiters spend less time fighting with software, they spend more time doing what actually matters, having conversations with clients and candidates. Several of our clients at Recruitment Coach have made the switch, and they're telling me it's transforming their operations. If you want to see it in action, book a demo at recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. That's recruitmentcoach.com/recruiterflow. You already understand the benefits of posting video content on LinkedIn. The problem is time. After all, you're a recruiter, not a full-time content creator. Trusted Voice Video was built for busy recruitment business owners who know that video matters, but they don't want another job added to their plate. One 30-minute session per month gives you 30 days of short-form video content. We plan the topics, guide the conversation, edit the footage, and deliver ready-to-post videos. You'll never be stuck wondering what to say. You'll never worry about how you look or sound. We coach you through the session so you come across as clear, confident, and credible, even if you hate seeing yourself on camera. My colleague Sanjay manages the whole process. He already produces this podcast and my own video content, so if you like my content, then why not let us create yours as well? If you want your content working for you 24/7, head to recruitmentcoach.com/video and book a free strategy call.
It works for us.
I think that's super interesting because not only is it human nature to want to help other people, especially if you can relate to them or they remind you of some aspect of yourself, right? So, I can see people admiring your entrepreneurialism and the fact that, hey, these two young guys are starting something. And then at the same time, it's that balance between making sure they are clear. You are experienced. You do know what you're doing, right? So it's not like they're taking a risk on a couple of newbies who are really just figuring it out, right? So you've got the combination of experience, but we're launching our own thing. And like, who do you know who, you know, would be worth me connecting with? And so you're soliciting referrals and generating business that way. And maybe they want to help you in your success story, right? Do you think that Americans are maybe admire entrepreneurs more than Brits? Like, do you think there's a sense that, hey, I admire what Seb and Charlie are doing here and I'm rooting for them?
There's a brilliant quote from Jony Ive. I discovered this. This is such a niche reference, but I was watching Stephen Fry in America. That was one of my favorite documentaries. But he interviews Jony Ive, who's the mastermind behind the iPod and the iMac and was Steve Jobs' right-hand man. But he's a Brit living in San Francisco. And he said something along the lines of, you know, in America, there's a distinct kind of lack of cynicism. And there's just kind of an open-mindedness for ideas. And ideas are obviously so fragile, right? And I think that when you go out on your own and try something new, you know, the idea can get squashed very quickly. And as Brits, you're naturally risk averse. So I do agree with that. I think in America, when somebody puts a bet on themselves and really goes for it, there is, you know, and I'm not saying that England doesn't have that, but it's definitely kind of on steroids in America. People love that and they'll give you a shot, but you've got to come prepared, right? It can't be desperate. It's got to be intentional.
Got it. All right. Thanks for that little nugget. That's really cool. So you got your first retainer on day one. So that, and look, now I can understand why you're profitable from like every quarter. Is the retain model is much more forgiving, right, than the contingent one. And you're not going to waste time chasing mirages that don't amount to anything. So that makes total sense. What other kind of keys do you think allowed you to get the momentum going quite quickly?
Yeah. This is going to sound very trite, but I mean, we just worked so hard. Like we, you know, when you first start a business, even I, you know, in my opinion, even if you've had 10 years in the industry, you got to just have that start from zero mindset. And so for Charlie and I, like, you know, we go to the gym in the morning, of course, but, you know, we'd be in the office at like, you know, 7:30, 7:45, and we'd work till 9 o'clock every night. And for those of you, you know, who've lived in New York and or Chicago and you've done the winters, it's like, it's freezing outside and we'd walk to the office every day and back. And so The first 6 months were an absolute grind, and we definitely had fun and we'd celebrate the wins. But I think another kind of key to success is just, you know, in recruiting, even if you're not particularly good, if you work very, very hard, you will see success if you are using the right tools, of course. So I think the hard work piece was there. The fact that we were specialized very specifically at the beginning in accounting and finance for private equities in Chicago also helped us, because for us, we knew almost like tongue in cheek, we knew the names of every single kind of, you know, senior audit manager that worked at PwC or EY that had private equity experience. And so the combination of very hard work, a game plan, and deep specialization in a market, I think that that's not a bad place to start if you're a recruiter.
Definitely. Absolutely. This is all making total sense. So very tight niche specialization, combined with just absolutely grinding to get the business off the ground, and then trying to get retained. Did you only work retained, or did you kind of do whatever you could get?
No, definitely didn't work only retained. I think that we did work majority kind of exclusive work though. And if it wasn't exclusive, we would make sure that we had a very clear line of communication with multiple stakeholders at the business. And we knew on a very first principles level, the sort of, the economic pain points that were tied to that hire, and that we were pretty bought in there. So that, you know, if we were working a search and we were competing, at the very least, we knew all of the players in the game and we knew exactly what was at stake, so that we could be quite intentional with the way that we were working. You know, companies that might say, hey, yeah, we're working with quite a few agencies, you know, throw a few resumes in the hopper if you're interested. We were quite intentional at steering away from that, even when, you know, early days, you kind of eat what you can kill. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes total sense. So, but then you quite quickly started hiring people. And then, of course, as any business owner knows, it's tough to identify and attract the right people, much less than, you know, develop them and then retain them and then manage them, help them to maximize their production while you're still running a desk. And then you lose people, which is a kick in the balls, right? Because you've poured so much of like energy and time into people, and then, you know, and then they leave. It feels, you know, that feels hard, right? Because it's like two steps forward, one step back. What were some of the other kind of lessons that you guys, you know, took away from the first few years of trying to grow in venture?
Well, I think after 2 years, we, you know, from lots of, you know, different corners of advice, including the Apex Group, we realized that we needed to specialize. And so we did a kind of a relatively sort of objective analysis of where our business was, and renewables was booming. We had a really talented recruiter in that seat who has since gone and started his own business. And, you know, on a human level as well, we liked the mission of renewables. So there was that nice balance of kind of economic opportunity, and there was the social piece as well. A lot of technology was pouring into that space. So we realized that we had to specialize. As I kind of mentioned, we learned the power of that on day one in recruiting. So we landed on renewables and went all in on that. And that was a brilliant decision. It kind of set us up for, you know, the years between, you know, 2021 or 22 and 2025. So that was one big lesson. And then, as I mentioned, I'll go back to it, but Charlie and I mapped out, well, in creating the academy process, we ultimately mapped out every single step of how to do recruiting. We kind of went to the lab and tried to, I remember reading this book called The Qualified Sales Leader by John McMahon, who's ex-bigwig at MongoDB. And so we mapped out every single step of the recruitment process, you know, initial screen, resume sub, first time interview. And then we would start to quantify the KPIs and tie those to financial values. And so we were able to kind of build the toolkit to understand how to generate consistent performance, where bottlenecks were, versus what I think we were probably doing before, which was, let's find brilliant candidates, send them at clients, manage the process and hope for the best. But there wasn't any kind of science behind the numbers. So I think those two things, the specialization piece and the science behind recruiting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You don't know this, but I've just launched a program with a former client of ours, Rebecca Hastings, called the AI Sales System. And the principle behind it is that, like, AI is not going to fix your sales. It's a system that will fix your sales. And you need to, like, the process comes first. The tools come, like, afterwards, right? So, like, the step one is, what is your sales process? Like, the time from, you know, and initially we're just looking at getting the first appointment with a client. So that piece, like, what's your cadence? What are the steps? What pieces of content or value can you add to those steps? What channels? And then the tools map on after. And then how can I use AI? For example, Rebecca's got this brilliant AI agent that she built that goes and researches every prospect at the beginning of the day, so that, and then creates a report for her. So when she's on the phone, she already knows everything about this client. But that all gets added on after. It starts with having this system. And so it sounds like you guys really broke down every single step of your client and candidate journeys. Anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, well, kudos to Rebecca. That sounds brilliant. And I think, it's an interesting topic of conversation about how AI plays into the science of recruiting. And I think that a lot of people are a little bit scared and they go, oh, AI is going to, and I can talk more about that. You know, we're deep into that space at the moment. But, when you say AI is coming for recruiting, it's like, I wrote an article about this on LinkedIn. It's like, well, which part? It's like if you went into, a deli and you had a sandwich shop, it's like, you say, oh, AI is coming for the whole shop. It's like, well, are they procuring the goods? Are they doing the slicing? Are they serving? Like, so there's AI tools for different sections of the recruitment process. And I think that you got to be conscious about where you're spending your money. And, I won't go down that rabbit hole. That's a big conversation.
Okay. Well, we'll see if we get to that. So look, what I'm amazed that, like, kudos to you for building a $15 million revenue business in only, like, what, 7 years or something. How much of that is permanent and how much is contract?
100% perm.
Wow.
I think, we had maybe one contract throughout that time, but yeah, all perm.
So $15 million in, like, permanent placement fees. That's crazy. Like, most people don't get to that size in like 20 years, much less in 7 years. So, what are there any other, like, if a recruitment business owner is listening, thinking, gosh, I really admire what Seb and Charlie have created there. What's the, like, single most important piece of advice you would have about scaling a business?
So outside of specialization, I think one of the most important things I learned was the power of the first time interview and how that should be your benchmark as an entire company. I think of my business in two halves, before I understood that and after. And it was understanding the power of the first time interview that allowed us not just to grow revenues, but to grow them in a very consistent and methodical way, to the point where we got to 2025, end of last year, where we did about 4 million top line and again, 25-30% EBIT. And really, just in simple terms, what we did, and I borrow this from, I stand on the shoulders of my mentors who taught me this, but, you know, figure out the value of your first time interview. So, you know, if you've done 100 interviews that quarter and you've made $100, right, your interview's worth $1. And so when you then see how many interviews are coming through the pipeline for your business month after month, you can see the value of that first time interview. And if the value is staying the same, right, you can measure growth quite consistently and you know how hard to push. You can also start to hire people if you're maintaining that quality. If your first time interview valuation starts to drop, then of course you can attack the bottlenecks that are behind that. But it's ultimately figuring out what is the value of the first time interview and then what are all the different inputs that are creating that. And naturally, as a business, if you just focus purely on, let's drive the volume of first-time interviews while consistently increasing the value of that metric, you're able to quite quickly grow those quarters higher around that number. And then, of course, you can bounce off of that. The second most important is the value of your vacancies, right? But I'd say that one tool was very, very good for us. And it also adds, like, just such a layer of celebration to the weekly wins, because you're not always going to do a deal as a small business. But if your team lands 25 first-time interviews and you know your first-time interview is valued at $3,500, you can really celebrate that because you know the revenue is coming. So I would say that piece was really essential in our development as entrepreneurs.
Okay, that's awesome. So first-time interviews is the king KPI, and you worked out the value of each first-time interview. Presumably that's the placement value divided by the average number of interviews it takes to make a placement?
Yeah. So, I mean, you really want 6 months of data. So if you can, you know, get your last 6 months, how many interviews did you do and how much revenue did you do, right? And then you divide the revenue by the number of interviews. That's the value of your first time interview. And then you can say, okay, so for Q3, our goal for this quarter is going to be 120 first time interviews. And that should create this amount of revenue based on our current value. You can build your company targets around that and then benchmark your company performance as you scale towards that. And then once you crack that, you can then break that down to the individual level. So you might say, you know, Sarah over here, her first-time interviews are worth $5,000, but Joe down here is only worth $1,500 based on the way that they're working. And then that can help you design coaching tools to upskill that individual depending on what their needs are, or perhaps maybe, you know, have a little bit more grace when you see somebody only do maybe two interviews in a week, but you know that their interviews are worth $5,000 or $6,000. So yeah.
That's awesome. What were the key things that you identified that would drive first-time interviews?
So I think the biggest thing for us, so again, just speaking from experience, was new vacancies. I think that one of the dangers of this, right? And again, just to kind of double click on this, if your first time interviews are going up, but your revenue is staying the same or declining, you then want to look under the hood and go, right, which clients did I actually generate those first time interviews from? Because we all know the story where you have one client who interviews everybody because they're not quite sure what they're doing on the recruitment front, and that will just blow up your. So what I'm looking for to drive first time interviews is new qualified vacancies coming through the door, where we're building to a pipeline of like 4 to 5 candidates, absolute max. So I'd say that is probably the biggest follow-on, I'd say.
Okay, excellent. You raised a point which has come up twice on my recent coaching calls, which is clients who love to interview and never pull the trigger. You mentioned like you're building to a 4 or 5 candidates max that you're shortlisting. What was your, how did you set the ground rules with clients so they understood that, look, we're not just going to keep recruiting forever here. You have to choose from, we've already showed you the best. You need to choose someone from that shortlist.
Well, I think it comes all the way back to the discovery call. Like when you're doing the intake call and figuring out the vacancy, like as an account manager or as an account breaker, you need to quantify the meaning of this search. Like, why are you hiring this person? What happens if you don't hire this person? How does this person weigh into your project goals, you know, over the next 6 months? And if their answer is, it's not really anything specific. We just think that we kind of need this person. Immediately, the alarm bells have got to start ringing. So the thing is, if you call them and say, hey, what happens if you don't make this hire? And they'll say, well, we're competing in a really busy geographic region. And if we don't hire this project director, we're simply going to fall behind and we'll lose market share. And this is going to be detrimental for our investors and XYZ. So now, you know, when you're on week 6 or 7 of the process and they're dragging their feet and you call them up and say, hey, Mark, can we talk about our candidate pipeline? They're going cold. And they say, oh, Seb, I'm really busy, but we've got that interview scheduled. Can we talk next week? You go, well, hang on a second, Mark. Let me just ask you this. You told me if you don't hire this person by April 1st, you're going to lose X amount of market share and your investors aren't going to be happy. I've just spoken to our lead candidate. I've got some updates. Do you have 5 minutes? And that 5 minutes will turn into 10, and then you can requalify the job. But I think it really just comes down to quantifying the pain that the client has around that hire.
Yes.
And ensuring that that's real.
Absolutely agree, 100%. It's funny. Just literally yesterday, I was running a call about client acquisition, and even experienced recruiters I'm finding are not qualifying their jobs effectively. Like the client says, oh, this is really urgent. And they just take that like they assume what that means instead of digging deeper and going, okay, well, what's driving that urgency? What's the consequence? Like, when's the drop dead date? When do you absolutely have to have someone in place? And if you don't hit that time scale, then what impact does that have on the business, right? What's the consequence of, you know, that time slipping? And what's the cost of that open vacancy? And how does that affect you personally, right? And so until you dig in and find, as you said, the pain, like until you find the pain, you haven't qualified the vacancy to the full extent. And so you may be on a different, like they say it's urgent, but urgent to them might mean something totally different to urgent to you. And if you know what's driving the urgency, you can keep them accountable and keep the timelines moving forward. So
to your point as well, Mark, like I think as well, like if you haven't quantified the pain properly, then creating urgency is just going to annoy them. Like, you don't want to, like when they see your email come through or they see your name come through on their phone, you want them to think, okay, Seb's calling me. Yep, I should take this call. Let's talk about something, you know. But if they're like, oh, so Seb is pushing me again on this candidate, it's just like the feeling that you create with your customer is so important. And so again, yeah, I won't talk about too much about that. But I think again, your point is so good.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I've never heard anyone talk about that. Is when they see your name in their inbox or they see your name come up on their phone, what feeling do they have about that? That's a really interesting idea. Are they feeling like, oh, every time Seb calls, it's a worthwhile conversation. I get something out of that, either, you know, that's going to help me grow my business, or do they think, oh, it's that guy, he's chasing and pestering me again, right? And trying to pressure me to make a decision. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Now, is that all in the way that you set things up on the discovery call, or are there any other keys that you've found in order for them to associate positive feelings and value to that taking that call?
Yeah, so maybe looking at the question in the reverse, like what do you not want to do, right? And where do I think that so many recruiters lose market share? It's because they haven't qualified the job properly, and they're being incredibly pushy about their candidates that are average and don't really fit the spec. And they haven't also created a timeline for that hire. So it's like just pushing something they don't really want or need. So looking at that worst case scenario and thinking, right, when I first take the call, let's make sure that I have very real data around why this hire is even happening, who it's reporting into, and how that direct hiring manager's job measure is benchmarked against the success of this hire. Like if this hiring manager doesn't hire this person, how is that going to affect their yearly performance review and things like that? That's just a few, like if you don't have that kind of data and then you haven't gone into the details of like, what are you looking for? Why? What kind of experience they need? It's all just kind of random. So you just need to be unbelievably intentional and thorough with why it's happening, what they're looking for, and how your solution helps everybody achieve their business goals.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. And you're absolutely right about if you're showing them candidates that in their mind are not relevant, then that's immediately like going to destroy the energy that you've got with this client. So we need to really nail down what's the agreed search criteria. It's 1, 2, 3, and maybe 4 key things. And then you need to show them that your candidate has those 3 or 4 success criteria, right? Otherwise, you know, they're going to think we're just wasting time here. So Seb, I want to get to the big move here, because you've built, I think you said, a 4 million per year recruiting firm, which is fantastic. And from what I understand from our previous conversations, you're kind of blowing that up and creating something new, which seems like a crazy thing to do. So can you explain what you're pivoting to and why you've decided to do that?
For the record, InVenture, the business that we grew, is still thriving and doing well, and is now actually a part of the Generate umbrella that we've created. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that our focus as business owners is now on Generate. So I guess to kind of describe what Generate is and our mission here, I think it's probably best to give you some context. So, you know, I think a lot of recruiters are observing this in the market where the industry is kind of splitting into two buckets. On the one hand, you have a lot of recruiters who source candidates, match candidates, and then scheduled interviews. And I think we all know that AI is coming for that job rather rapidly, and it's going to eliminate a large part of the market. However, with all the things being said about AI, on the other side of that coin, I think this ridiculously high leverage and empowered recruiter is emerging that has very easy and cheap access to the best AI and technology out there. And their personal brand has never been more important. I mean, I've spoken to hundreds of recruiters over the last 6 months, and there's a lot of head nodding when I say it's your character and your personal identity that's winning those client logos versus perhaps the company that you work for. And so you look at those two things, and then you look at America today with 52% of people being entrepreneurial or at least meaningfully self-employed. And again, with just context, the recruitment industry structurally hasn't really changed that much in about 30 years. So we thought to ourselves, instead of just scaling an agency based on headcount and volume, about sort of 9 months ago or so, Charlie and I thought, I think our mission is to build the infrastructure for the next era of recruiter, which we think to be more entrepreneurial, more high leverage. And ultimately, we think that instead of America having maybe 26,000 agencies, you know, in 5 years, which it does today, it's going to be more like 100,000 agencies. About 80% of all companies have less than 10 people. And we think that it's going to fragment even more. However, with that first entrepreneurial step, it's a very kind of scary first step. It's often a little bit ambiguous from the legal and the admin. And even if you do conquer that first step, right, there's then the fears of, okay, well, am I going to plateau as a recruiter by going it alone? You know, what happens if I have a down month? How am I learning and developing? And so with all of these things in mind, we thought instead of building an agency for volume, let's build the infrastructure for this next era of recruiting that we think is going to happen. And that's going to come in the form of a platform that we're branding to be ultimately an accelerator. So entrepreneurs take the first step. We do all the admin and all the heavy lifting, and I won't go too much into the features. But ultimately, once they've taken that step, they're then continuously pushed forward to drive even more production, even more revenue through access to not only the best technology and tools. For example, we've built an application called Millie to help with mid-funnel execution, but also through being in a community of other very high-performing entrepreneurs, that kind of really high-leverage empowered recruits that I mentioned. And so that's the mission with Generate. And we think that by creating this platform, it's going to really sort of increase the reputation and the functional purpose of recruiting by just aligning incentives. And, you know, when entrepreneurs are winning and working with clients, we think it just elevates the level of our craft and our practice. So that is the mission. And we launched January 5th. We're already up to about 20 users, and our goal is to be 100 within year one. So yeah.
That's phenomenal. 20 people in a month, just over 5 weeks or something. That's insane. So, okay, I'm still unclear. So I understand your vision of the future, which is that more fragmentation, more people setting up their own recruiting firm, which is really just like their solo lifestyle businesses, right? But you guys were getting great traction with the traditional model. So I'm still unclear as to what eureka moment led to you going, do you know what? This is working, but there's something else that could be even better. And let's put all our energy into building that. What was the inspiration behind that?
I wish that there was a big dramatic story where, there was another New York moment where Charlie came into my bedroom and said, we've got to move to LA. But really, there wasn't. I think that one strength that Charlie and I have is that we are nerds about recruitment and our industry. We're always reading things. We're listening to the podcasts. We're reading the SIA reports. We love that stuff. And so I think really it was more so a kind of a slow realization that what we were doing was really, really good. Like an Inventure is still thriving today. Our output per head is very strong. But we were kind of looking at this from, let's maybe adjust our focus from a good opportunity to a great one. Instead of building an agency, let's build the infrastructure, let's build a platform for recruiters. And so it was, as I say, it was kind of like a slow realization. And again, you know, as we always do, we start to put pen to paper on the business model, the financials, the, you know, the marketing collateral, things like that. And before you know it, we had a business idea, and we went for it and started branding it. And Charlie, I think, came up with the name Generates. But I think there was no eureka moment, but I think that I wouldn't be the only recruiter to say that there's been a slow realization about what the future is going to hold for our industry and how much it's going to change, I think.
So let's talk about the corporate logo versus personal brand. And I think I agree to a point, but can you elaborate on what you mean by that? Like the importance of your personal logo versus the corporate logo?
Yeah. I spoke to a recruiter yesterday even, and he said something along the lines of, you know, this is the era of the boutiques. And I think that people, you know, when I say people, clients, I think they like to work with very high leverage, nimble recruitment individuals or firms, smaller businesses, because there's more accountability, there's a greater alignment of incentives, and it's just cleaner and faster. And so if you amplify that to the most extreme level, you have an individual, right, winning logos by saying, hey, this is my specialization, this is my network, and this is my level of accountability to the search. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a few reasons that kind of sparked this thought. I think when I first started my business, as I mentioned, like, you know, when you're 24 years old with 3 years of experience and you can close a retainer with a big private equity firm on day one of business, I think that opens your eyes a little bit to how far you can go by backing yourself and just, you know, coming prepared and having the right story for your client. And I ultimately just think that, like, you know, in this day and age, when a client decides who they're going to work with, they don't remember, you know, the logo. They remember the person's name, right? And so I think that that's going to continue to amplify. And it's the reason why, for example, on LinkedIn, you know, people don't particularly care about following company logos. They care about following individuals. And I think that's only going in one direction. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, that is 100% true. Like we're explaining to our clients all the time that, because they're asking, should we post on the company LinkedIn page or my personal LinkedIn page? And like, okay, ideally both, but your personal profile is the one that you should really focus on because you're going to get so much more traction there. People follow other people, right? They don't really follow companies to the same extent. So that makes total sense. And so I think in a previous conversation, correct me if I'm wrong, you took some kind of inspiration from eXp Realty. Is that story worth telling?
Yeah. So eXp Realty. Well, again, like, and I could talk about this for hours because I love the eXp story. But anyhow, there's a business called eXp Realty who were founded in 2009, and they went from zero to the largest real estate agency in the world within 10 years. And they did this by approaching the market in quite a similar way to what we're trying to do now. Real estate in 2009 was very fragmented. The individual was on the billboard, not the company logo. And this gentleman called Glenn Sanford thought, well, let's build an agency that's all about the individual, basically a platform that gives them the highest commissions on the market, the best technology, and total freedom to run their desk. And then there was this revenue share piece on the side to help with recruiting. And it went ridiculously well for them. You know, they went from, you know, as I say, zero to a NASDAQ traded business. And above all, the way that they transformed the industry was, you know, again, real estate was quite similar to where recruiting is today. The notion of being a $1 million producer, you know, which I know how hard it is to get to, like it's not an anomaly, but it's certainly something that's put on a pedestal. And if you look at where real estate is today and what eXp did, they transitioned that by giving these commission packages and the tools. And it's a business that now mints about 300 new millionaires every single year through aligning incentives and just giving them a platform to go out there and kill it instead of, you know, being under a big corporate banner with extremely dense overhead and corporate wastage. It's just incredibly lean and agile. So we saw that the way that eXp attacked that market, and we thought, you know what, recruiting shares a lot of similarities. And as I mentioned, it hasn't structurally really changed for about 30 or 40 years. I think it's absolutely ripe for disruption. And so the way that they structured their business is something that we took a lot of inspiration from. And we've even got our referral fund included there, which is a big recruiting tool. So we took so much inspiration. We're actually in contact with some of their kind of European directors who helped steering our journey. But yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. EXP is a great story. If you haven't heard of them, look it up. It's a brilliant entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah. And awesome. The other thing which I've heard you talk about is your entrepreneur economy thesis. And you've kind of alluded to that a little bit, but can you say more about what you believe that shift means for the recruiting industry?
So in short, the shift from a more fragmented industry with much more kind of individual entrepreneurs versus agencies, that's a question.
Yeah. Like what are you basing that on? Why do you think that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So, you know, I mentioned that like 52% of Americans today consider themselves at least meaningfully self-employed or entrepreneurial. The reason why that statistic is interesting is because it's about double where it was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. This gig economy, this ability to basically work on your own time and with freedom and autonomy, all these things, it's becoming more and more popular. Now, there's an array of reasons I think that's happening. I think that social media and people seeing each other's success is probably a huge driver in that. I think access to technology that helps people amplify their skill set and monetize it on their own time is another, you know, reason that's happening. But I mean, if you look at recruiting and if you look at every good recruiter out there, I might be biased, but I think it's got to be one of the most entrepreneurial industries on the planet. Like, you're not selling software, you're not selling coffee beans, you're selling a promise that you can deliver a service to the client in the future by finding good candidates. It is just so on, it's like have a phone and a laptop and I can go out there and do my job. So if you look at the macroeconomic trends of where the gig economy is going, and then you look under a microscope of what the, you know, the bread and butter of recruitment is in terms of the soft skills, I think it's going to be the next industry that's hit by this. And you look at trainers, you look at wealth managers, you look at realtors, they're all pivoting to this kind of entrepreneurial structure. They look for platforms instead of companies. And so it's my hypothesis that recruiting will be next. And while we've got about 270,000 recruiters in America, I don't think that that number will necessarily diminish. But I think that instead of 26,000 agencies, it's going to be more like 100,000 agencies who take advantage of this more autonomous way of work.
Yeah, I'm sure that COVID and the remote working thing has accelerated that, right? Because, you know, it almost created this whole new paradigm where there was this shift from just people being used to going to a job at an office every day, and then that was all disrupted. So then along with that, it kind of creates new possibilities in your imagination, right? You think, well, if you can do this remotely, then that creates the opportunity to, you know, to create my own business. Or it also means that I don't even necessarily have to recruit in my local city, right? I could conceivably do, like, it just creates all kinds of new possibilities sloshing around in my brain, which, you know, leads to some interesting effects in the market. Let's talk about AI and how you guys are leveraging AI at Generate and what your thoughts are on to what extent AI is going to disrupt the industry and or replace some, you know, portion of it.
So I think as I alluded to, sourcing, candidate matching, and interview scheduling is kind of taken care of. With that said, for the deep specialists, there is corners of the market that automation is not going to solve for. Like, you need relationships there. However, I do think that AI is creating this bifurcation in the marketplace where the low-level, transactional, not particularly niche recruiter is very quickly losing their market share to in-house. In terms of where I think AI is going and what we're doing with Generate, so we've got a great tech stack that's AI-enabled, sourcing, all this kind of stuff. But we've built an AI application called Millie, which we've invested a lot of money in. And we've got two unbelievable engineers who have helped us build this. And ultimately, you know, if you look at the the market share that recruitment agencies have lost to in-house recruiters since the advent of AI, since the big uptake of it. I think it's a testament to the fact that the way recruiters are using AI right now is not necessarily working. I think that we're trying to solve for an execution problem with more leads. The gold standard in recruiting today is to place 1 in 4 vacancies that we take on. I think most other sales industries would laugh at that number. I don't think it's a particularly good one.
No,
and so agencies are saying...
Yeah, it's appalling. Like, that means 75% of your time is wasted.
Exactly right. And so I think that right now, agencies and software are saying, I know how to solve for this 1 in 4. Let's flood the top of the funnel with more leads, more email spam, more blasting. And I just think that's wrong. I think we have the business. I think we have the demand. And so the whole mission of Millie is basically to help recruiters execute more of what they have, to close more like 3 out of 4 vacancies that they have on. I can get into the product features, but in short, it's a mid-funnel execution tool. It's helping you control your pipeline and close more of your business instead of try to solve your problems with more prey and spray. And whether this is good or bad, it's half the reason that people have joined Generate is access to our Millie tool that we've demoed them. So yeah.
So I agree 100% that people are using AI in probably the wrong part of the process, and they're just like more automation of mediocre messages to clients and candidates isn't going to lead to more billing, right? What do you mean by mid-funnel execution?
So mid-funnel execution, I think, is anything that you can categorize from once you've done your initial screen with a candidate or an intake call with a client through to closing them. It's the 1 million different things that occur throughout that process. Little kind of cookie crumbs that a candidate might leave in terms of how serious they are about the job. Again, some of the things that we mentioned about client buy-in. There's just so many different things that occur during a process, which I think will snowball and cause a recruiter to lose control and facilitate that 1 in 4 vacancy closing ratio. So when I think of mid-funnel execution and the mission of Millie, it's a tool that's ultimately going to help people close much more of what they have by ultimately guiding decisions throughout the recruitment process between first meeting and closing.
Okay, that's cool. But how does it do that? I'm having trouble visualizing that.
Yeah. So
I know you're describing something which is probably easier to show, but do your best.
Okay. So it's fully integrated into your CRM. So we've built all kinds of webhooks and things, knocked down all the APIs. So it's fully embedded. It's listening to, it's looking at all your data through your CRM and your calls and your emails and all this kind of stuff. We've spent probably the last 5 years interviewing who I believe to be 3 of the best recruiters on the planet. We've gone through an array of situational scenarios in recruiting. What happens if a candidate says this? What happens if a client says that? So we've gleaned all of that knowledge. It's recorded, and we've built a massive corpus of knowledge, like the absolute best practices in recruitment. So all of the inputs from your recruiter talking to candidates and clients, that's coming through the funnel. It's being pushed through our corpus of knowledge, the best possible things that you could do in that scenario. And then it's giving you really tangible outputs in the form of emails, action plans, transcripts. It's giving you a logic as to why Millie chose these emails. And then there's an agentic feature which allows people to then rally with the tool and say, hey, this email's a bit too harsh. Let's make it softer. Let's make it a bit more consultative. It's learning from you as well in terms of your preference. And the beautiful thing about it is that it's leveraging the firepower of LLMs, but it's not using any of the LLM drift and calling people operators and asking to make the process clean. It's using our tokens from recruitment speak. So, in short, the way that manifests is a recruiter, instead of having maybe 1 learning moment with their manager each day, they're having like 30 because Millie's continuously showing them what to do. It's evaluating the risk on each deal, and it's pushing deals forward. It's pushing them down the field. And so, we've launched our V1. We've got an array of customers who are lined up to buy this tool. And, on top of Generate at the moment, we're about to go and raise a $3 million seed round to make Millie a category defining tool. And again, it's the same mission as Generate, right? It's amplifying the recruitment industry by aligning incentives and just making us better and producing a better result for the end user. And I think that if clients are getting more like a 3 out of 4 vacancy closing ratio, it's going to mean a better reputation for our industry. And again, it's just going to elevate our practice. So that's my spiel on AI.
That's cool. I love it. I think that's a brilliant use case for AI that's underutilized right now, is that looking at your own data and transcripts of your calls and giving like feedback, coaching, actionable insights. That's phenomenal. So what is, you've obviously evaluated a lot of tools and then built your own AI application, Millie. What is the tech stack that you've integrated Millie into?
So it's multi-model in terms of the way it taps into LLMs, and it's using our proprietary corpus of knowledge. But in terms of the APIs, at the moment, I mean, we can really plug into any APIs within reason.
What are the ones that you guys use in your business that you like?
So Loxo is our CRM. We've got RingCentral for our call scripts. We've got Gmail, and then we use Sourcewell for our tooling. So that's our current tech stack, but we're building integrations with Vincere, with Crelate, and then the email API is a very easy one. The big one to conquer is the database. So, you know, our plan with some of our capital is to ultimately have a tool that can tap into the top 10 databases. And as we win brilliant accounts and they're aligned in our mission, we'll spend the money and break down their APIs and integrate. So yeah.
This is maybe a little bit nerdy for some listeners, but by the way, you should talk to Recruiter Flow about the API there. But I understood that Loxo don't have an API and are difficult to connect with.
They're difficult. I won't talk too much about this because I think Matt Chambers and his mission with Loxo is brilliant. I'm a big fan of his. Their API is definitely a bit of a beast to tackle. That's why I have two absolute cracked engineers. But there is an API key. I think Atlas is the only one whose API key is in the hopper that they're working on. But I mean, it's a new product and they're making a huge splash, and I'm a big fan of theirs too. So yeah.
Okay, fantastic. That's awesome. Seb, I know, like me, you're a big reader. Favorite business books that either classics that you recommend or something you've read recently that had a big impact?
I think if you're a startup and you've just begun building your agency, I think one of the most impactful books I've ever read is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. It is just such a brilliant book, and it's, you know, you put all of the other kind of more high level psychological motivation books. This one is just a first principles book on how to build a business. So The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz, that's definitely in the Hall of Fame. If you're looking to shape culture, John Wooden on leadership, I'm biased because I went to UCLA, but for the Brits and UK folks who don't know him, he's one of the most successful coaches in history. And then I'll throw in just a modern one. I'm reading at the moment, I'm just about to finish, I'm a big fan of Walter Isaacson, and I've just finished his Steve Jobs one, which is very overdue, but it's just another masterpiece from him. So those are my three of today.
Fantastic. Three great ones. So listen, if someone's listening and they're inspired by what you're doing, Seb, and they want to reach out and find out more, what's the best step for them to take?
So if you're an entrepreneurial recruiter and you're interested in taking that first step, or perhaps you're, you know, a boutique agency owner that wants to be a part of an accelerator, again, just hit me up on LinkedIn or go onto our website. We are Generate, and we have a type form where you can get in touch. And if some of the things that I was mentioning on Millie sound like they could be of interest to your business, I'm running demos. Go to millie.ai. That's millie.ai. Can book you in for a demo and get you onboarded. And LinkedIn is always the best place for me as well.
Seb, this was awesome. I've been cheering you on from the sidelines for a few years now, and really impressed by what you and Charlie have accomplished and you know, continue to innovate in the industry. So thanks again.
Thank you, Mark. I've been listening to your podcast right from the beginning, and it's an honor and a privilege to be on, and keep doing what you're doing. It's awesome, man.
All right, sir. Have a great day. I'll see you again.
All right. Cheers, Morgan.
Take care. All right. What was your biggest takeaway from that conversation? By the way, if you're watching on YouTube, please let me know in the comments. For me, the top two are, number one, know the value of each first-time interview. So Seb tracks one number above everything else. He takes his total revenue over 6 months, divides it by the number of first-time interviews in that period, and that tells him exactly how much each interview is worth. He's then able to use that number to set targets, coach his team, and celebrate wins before the deals even close. And the second thing was qualify the pain before you work the search. So Seb's point of view was simple. If you have not determined what happens to the client when this role remains open, in other words, what's the consequence or the impact of not filling this job, or, you know, for every month that goes by that the role remains open, you've not qualified the job properly yet. Once you know the real consequences of not hiring, then it's much easier to hold the client accountable to the timelines and keep the process moving. Without that, you're chasing a search that was never that serious to begin with. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please let me know by giving us a review on Apple or Spotify, and I will see you next time.